Hey Grand Rapids, welcome to the Grid Weekly Digest, your source for local news and media commentary for the people. Brought to you by the Grand Rapids Institute for Information Democracy, in partnership with nobody and nothing. This week, we're covering the town hall hosted by State Rep Christian Grant with Representative Hillary Scholten at Ottawa Hills High School. Our review of the first episode of the GRPD All Access show on HBO. And strategies and tactics for political movements in the current political climate in the United States. On April 3rd, State Representative Christian Grant hosted a 90-minute town hall meeting at Ottawa Hills High School. Her special guest was Representative Hillary Scholten, along with three Grand Rapids City Commissioners, Lisa Knight, Marshall Kilgore, and Alicia Marie Belchak. As is customary at these meetings, the politicians get to speak first, with Representative Grant saying a few words and then inviting Congresswoman Scholten to speak. As Scholten was approaching the podium, someone yelled, "Stop voting for genocide." As Grid has documented over the past 18 months, Representative Scholten has consistently voted to support Israel as they carry out genocide with billions of dollars of U.S. weapon sales. Representative Scholten spoke about how bad the Republicans are, completely ignoring the fact that she has voted with the GOP on numerous issues since January. Plus, she failed to acknowledge that the Democratic Party is essentially allowing all of this to happen without any real fight. Scholten did mention that she had introduced legislation that would make the DOGE committee work more transparent, saying that they weren't trying to shut it down or arrest Elon Musk. Someone from the audience said that Scholten should be proposing that Musk be arrested, which was met by a loud applause. Representative Scholten then took a few questions, but after 10 minutes, she said that she had to leave. This meant that Scholten did not have to hear from people who had serious questions and feedback about her unconditional support for Israel and her voting with the GOP on three anti-immigrant policies. For the remaining hour, Representative Grant opened it up for questions and comments. But in most cases, Representative Grant and the three Grand Rapids City Commissioners chimed in, which took valuable time away from people who had things to say. I'm not suggesting that politicians not speak, but most of their responses were weak and often irrelevant, since they did not have anything concrete to suggest to people who were clearly angry and hurting. One questioner was demanding that the elected officials on stage be courageous and do what the people were asking, whether that was specific to the federal, state, or local government. The same questioners asked why Representative Grant did not support the many tenant-centered pieces of legislation that would have vastly improved the lives of hundreds of thousands of renters in Michigan. Representative Grant said she supported many of these bills, but if that were true, then why didn't she hold public hearings on them, especially since she was the Housing Committee chair? The truth is that during the lame duck session last November and December, the Democrats could have adopted these bills, but they chose not to. There were questions posed to the Grand Rapids City Commissioners, specifically about why they were not adopting a sanctuary policy. They all either danced around the issue or said that they were already doing it because of what the Foreign Nationals Policy states. As we have written previously, the Foreign Nationals Policy states, "The policy allows officers to provide assistance to federal immigration authorities when there is an emergency that poses an immediate danger to public safety or federal agents." Many of us from Grand Rapids Rapid Response to ICE and Movimiento Cosecha are all too familiar with the rhetoric of the city and the GRPD, which is in stark contrast to what they practice. See our article entitled "The Criminalization of Dissent in Grand Rapids" for more information. Near the end of the night, Gemma Lowe with Movimiento Cosecha, an immigrant-led movement, wanted to clarify a point and ask a question. Gemma's clarifying point was that the Congresswoman Scholten stated at the beginning of the night that she was working hard to support refugees and immigrants. Gemma pointed out that Representative Scholten in 2025 alone had voted for three anti-immigration bills. These are the Laken Riley Act, the Preventing Violence Against Women by Illegal Aliens Act, and the Agent Raul Gonzalez Officer Safety Act. Again, it was too bad that Representative Scholten wasn't there to be held accountable for her claim to support immigrants. The Movimiento Cosecha organizer then turned her attention to Representative Grant, stating that the Democrats promised the immigrant community that they would pass the Drive Safe bills, since in 2023 and 2024, Democrats controlled the State House and the State Senate and the Governor's Office. Yet, even during the lame duck session, they never put it to a vote. Moving on to episode 1 of the TV series featuring the GRPD called All Access Grand Rapids, we first hear from GRPD Police Chief Eric Winstrom. This makes complete sense, since not only is Winstrom a slick PR person, but he always wants to control the narrative about the GRPD. Winstrom states that when he came to Grand Rapids, trust in the Grand Rapids Police Department was at an all-time low. Unfortunately, the TV show doesn't provide any historical context for why the community did not trust the GRPD. Thankfully, here at GRID, we are happy to provide these additional details. For the 5 years before Winstrom came to Grand Rapids, there were numerous instances that contributed to the community's lack of trust when it came to the GRPD, such as GRPD stopping black youth and pulling guns on them, GRPD arresting Honesty Hodges, an 11-year-old black girl, while the cops were out looking for a black suspect, 100 black men coming to the Grand Rapids City Commission meeting to demand the city hold the GRPD accountable for their abuses in black neighborhoods, GRPD caught on video beating a black man in his car while the man's child was in the car, GRPD stopping two Latino youth at gunpoint, and GRPD calling ICE on Hilmar Ramos Gomez, a former U.S. Marine. Right after Winstrom fails to provide context for the community's distrust of cops, he says, "If there is no trust, that equals a more dangerous and more violent city." We wonder, a more dangerous and violent city for whom? Once the episode gets past the GRPD-dictated framing of the narrative, the episode moves into using a clock counter on the screen, footage of dispatch, and audio from calls regarding a shooting. The footage goes from an aerial shot to body cam footage where cops show up to find Amelier Penn lying dead on the ground. Winstrom then states that the local news was covering this issue, but that they failed to report that homicides predominantly happen in black neighborhoods. Again, there is no verification for such a claim and no commentary from those who might have a robust critique or response to Winstrom's claim. The episode then cuts to Winstrom and one of his captains at the GRPD headquarters reviewing body cam footage. Winstrom, clearly playing to the camera, says, "Here he is, a 15-year-old full of bullets." Next, there are two cops who are involved in the investigative aspect of homicides, where they talk about how hard it is to get witnesses coming forward. These two cops then go out into the community to ask neighbors near the shooting if they can access Ring doorbell camera footage. The episode then continues with some of this Ring camera footage shown, which adds to the drama, along with the music in the background. Next is a shot of one of the investigative cops looking right into the camera, saying that they couldn't imagine how the young man might have been feeling in this moment, and how the family might be dealing with it. This scene is clearly constructed, since the camera crew is the one asking the questions. Viewers of the episode then go into the home of Amelier Penn, where his mother is talking and grieving the loss of her son. This lasts a minute, then it is back to the GRPD headquarters, where the cops are looking at what Amelier Penn's phone messages were just before he died. From there, the episode cuts to footage of a vigil for Amelier. At 13 minutes into the episode, it shifts and goes to the GRPD killing of Patrick Leoya, where they use footage of the city's press conference and commentary from Chief Winstrom on the importance of showing the video of what happened in order to, quote, not lose the community's trust, end quote. At 14 minutes into the episode, Winstrom then speaks to the camera, essentially blaming the lack of community trust on the Patrick Leoya murder, which is now preventing people from coming forward on the death of Amelier Penn. Next, we see Winstrom at the garage bar, talking with people and telling them that they need to step forward if they know anything. At the 15-minute mark into the episode, viewers get to hear from Amelier's father, who talks about how difficult it has been and how he has been trying to be a soldier for his son. The GRPD then spots a witness to the shooting at a park and convinces him to get in the cruiser and come down to the station to tell them what he remembers. Back in the GRPD headquarters, one of the detectives says that someone named CP shot Amelier, but they don't have any proof. However, this doesn't prevent the GRPD from putting up an image of CP with his full name on the screen. In the next few minutes, one of the detectives talks about Amelier's father, who started posting images of CP on his Facebook page and was demanding that the GRPD go and arrest this guy. In addition, the detective states on camera that Amelier's father changed his Facebook profile to an image of a pistol and is talking about revenge. The detective says that this undermines what the cops are trying to do. The episode then cuts to the funeral of Amelier. About 26 minutes and 30 seconds into the episode, the cops start talking about these, quote, fight club, end quote, videos that were on Amelier's phone. The cops even then say that Amelier was involved in these fights and shows video of Amelier in a street fight with CP. Fight Club is the title of this episode. At about 29 minutes and 45 seconds into the episode, one of the detectives has potential witnesses at the GRPD headquarters and asks a young black person if CP was the shooter. The response was, "I don't know." Right after this, the detective talks with another cop, saying they have a text that they believe incriminates CP. The episode then jumps to a new shooting, where they show the footage. They believe it is this CP person. The episode shows the footage of the shooting repeatedly. The investigator on the shooting then brings Winstrom into the case and shows him footage convincing Winstrom that CP is the shooter, claiming that they can let the prosecutor make the decision if what they have is enough. The next scene is with roughly 15 GRPD cops in a meeting being ordered to go look for CP. The detective then says, looking directly into the camera, quote, "It's time to arrest this dude," end quote. After that, for the next 2 minutes, the episode shows cops in riot gear at the door and then entering the home and taking custody of CP. All of this is done with dramatic music for effect. The few remaining minutes of the episode take place in the GRPD headquarters where cops are questioning CP and his mother and showing her pictures from the most recent shooting. Winstrom then, speaking to the camera, states that with CP in jail, maybe this gives witnesses an opportunity to come forth regarding Amelier's shooting. The murder of Amelier Penn still has not been resolved. This all-access Grand Rapids episode sure reminded me of the show Cops, where black bodies are criminalized and black people in urban settings are represented as thugs. This first episode affirms that stereotype, thus perpetuating structural racism and justifying state carceral violence. The episode also demonstrated that this TV series will be a highly constructed show, with the GRPD dictating the narrative about who they are and what they do. When it comes to strategies for the current political climate, protests and rallies can energize us, can help us to not feel isolated, and can even assist in developing community. However, it is important to engage in critical thinking about the protests and rallies that have taken place since January 20th. On March 8th, there was a large rally held in downtown Grand Rapids for International Women's Day. We published a reflection of that rally, where we pointed out that people not only have a right to be pissed off about what the Trump administration has done since January 20th, they ought to be pissed off. However, this shitshow is a constant for black people, indigenous people, immigrants, the working class, queer and trans people, and those with disabilities, and anti-war activists. Those who organized the recent hands-off rally heard some of this critique, especially from BIPOC organizers who are embedded in our community and are doing the ongoing work to address systemic oppression. The hands-off rally had a majority of BIPOC speakers and those who are deeply involved in the struggles that our communities are engaged in. Many of those same speakers invited the rally participants to join in the work they are engaged in, the kind of work that actually creates change and confronts systems of power and oppression. We have to be aware that politicians won't save us, because the political system in the U.S. is and has always been controlled by those with tremendous political and economic power. To the degree that there have been any political gains, it is because of the various social movements over the past 250 years. Slavery was abolished because of the abolitionist movement. Labor rights were won by workers fighting for workplace democracy. African Americans fought for more equality through the civil rights movement. And LGBTQ justice has been won by various movements led by those who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans, and queer. None of these gains were gifts from those in power, politicians, or the wealthy. Indeed, whatever gains have been won are because of the organized efforts by those directly involved in the struggle and those who are most affected. We need to begin to come to terms with the fact that regardless of which political party is in power, most people will still be experiencing oppression. Just look at what happened during the Biden administration. There were more deportations in the last 4 years than there were during the first Trump administration. The Biden administration approved more fossil fuel extractions on U.S. soil than the first Trump administration. The wealth gap expanded even further during the Biden administration, especially amongst the billionaire class. The Biden administration increased U.S. military funding every year for the past 4 years. The Biden administration increased funding for police, even in the era of Black Lives Matter. The Biden administration was completely and utterly complicit in the war crimes and genocidal policies of Israel. The Biden administration was not only silent, but enabled the repression targeted at the U.S. campus pro-Palestine movement, and the Biden administration did very little to address the ongoing housing crisis. Now, people are quick to say that what the current Trump administration is doing is much worse than what happened during the Biden years, and I would not dispute that. However, that is a pretty low bar. The fact is that all partisan politics in the US has shifted right, especially over the past several decades. This is clearly indicated in the Democrats' response to the current Trump administration, which has been weak, cowardly, and primarily performative. Now, I'm not suggesting that people shouldn't vote, but part of the problem with liberal strategy, especially when it is embraced by white liberals, is that they complain when Republicans have a majority, and then do little more than defend the Democrats. Even when those Democrats support militarism, genocide, the prison industrial complex, increased policing, corporate welfare, fossil fuel extraction, for-profit healthcare systems, the privatization of public services, unhealthy, exploitative, and polluting food systems, and on and on. So far, it seems like the primary strategy for resisting the new political environment of the Trump administration has been rallying. But rallies alone won't save us. They are only one tactic that organized people can use. Rallies don't fundamentally disrupt systems of power and oppression. What we need to be thinking about are goals, strategies, and tactics. If our goal is merely to get rid of Trump and Musk, then we will not address systems of power and oppression. Instead, our goals should reflect values and principles, like the dismantling of the prison industrial complex, building an economic system based on cooperation, direct democracy, and collective liberation. If we just want to get rid of Trump and return to life under a Democrat in the White House, then we have to come to terms with the fact that we don't really want change, and that the masses will still be subjected to poverty, institutional racism, deportation, police violence, homophobia, transphobia, a for-profit healthcare system, climate change, and unaffordable housing. Let's take the civil rights movement as an example. One could argue that the goal of the civil rights movement was to oppose racial discrimination and win greater equality. So what strategies did the civil rights movement utilize? One could argue that they used a legal strategy, an economic strategy, and a strategy of polarization. Polarization is a strategy to force systems of power and the general population to have to come to terms with inequities and injustices in the system of racial discrimination. The tactics that the civil rights movement utilized were vast, such as boycotts, strikes, lunch counter sit-ins, freedom rides, marches, and civil disobedience, all for the purpose of exposing the inherently unjust systems in society, as well as to create more equality. The Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act in the mid-1960s did not get the results the civil rights movement hoped for, so they began to demand more economic justice and the right to defend their communities. When Dr. King moved north in 1965 and 1966, his way of seeing the U.S. radically changed, which is why he condemned the evil triplets of racial discrimination, militarism, and capitalism. This evolution of the civil rights movement also involved resisting the U.S. military draft, condemning the U.S. war in Vietnam, supporting labor strikes, and supporting the right for black people to defend themselves, which is what groups like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, and the Deacons for Defense would embrace. This is also why Dr. King began to organize the Poor People's Campaign, which brought together black, Latino, Asian, Indigenous, and white people to promote an economic bill of rights. The social movements of the 1960s and 70s didn't focus on who sat in the White House, since both Johnson and Nixon were committed to pretty much the same policy of maintaining U.S. global military supremacy, capitalism, and white supremacy. The civil rights movement evolved. It learned from its mistakes. It took significant risks, and it confronted systems of power and oppression. In any sort of social movement or radical politics, we need to participate in disruptive actions, actions that are disruptive to systems of power and oppression. Instead of just holding signs outside of Social Security offices, why not go inside and disrupt their ability to do what they do? Instead of holding signs on highway overpasses, why not occupy the offices of members of Congress? Disrupting systems of power and oppression often means attacking their ability to make profits, conduct business as usual, and perpetuate harm. Capitalism is an insidious economic system that is based on profits and constant growth, but it is also rooted in exploitation and destruction, both of humans and of ecosystems. This is why the South African anti-apartheid campaign had, as one of its strategies, a boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign to disrupt businesses that were profiting off of apartheid. Another form of disruption is when we throw a monkey wrench into systems of power and oppression. During the End the Contract campaign that happened in Kent County in 2018 and 2019, which sought to get Kent County to end their contract with ICE, those involved in the campaign engaged in all kinds of disruptions. In fact, the kickoff to the campaign in late June of 2018 began with some 200 people showing up to the Kent County Commission meeting and shutting it down. The campaign disrupted numerous county meetings over the next several months, but it also took up space in the 4th of July parade and went into the Kent County Jail and made so much noise that those working the phones had a difficult time hearing callers. After the GRPD called ICE on Hilmar Ramos Gomez, the campaign shut down several Grand Rapids City Commission meetings, and on numerous occasions it disrupted traffic. The county never ended their contract, but ICE did in September of 2019, primarily because of all the bad press and bad PR the campaign had generated. Lastly, disruptions can mean engaging in actions that reduce the harm that is being perpetrated by systems of power and oppression. A great example of harm reduction is Indigenous people blockading fossil fuel corporations from continuing to build oil pipelines. According to a report put out by the Indigenous Environmental Network in 2021, Indigenous-led resistance campaigns against pipelines in the US and Canada have reduced greenhouse gas pollution by at least 25% annually since these campaigns began. Disruptions that reduce harm is exactly what Grand Rapids Rapid Response to ICE does, with their organized effort to mobilize people who have been trained to show up when people are targeted by ICE, to try to prevent them from disappearing immigrants from this community. Most of the examples we have discussed so far would also qualify as direct action. However, we want to explore what direct action is a bit more, and provide some additional examples. Direct action means that we take collective action to change our circumstances, without handing our power to an intermediary, whether they are bosses, politicians, or any other authority. Direct action means we take matters into our own hands, and not expect those in power to do what we want. Direct action often does not take the form of a protest. It can mean organizing a union where you work, starting a food cooperative, creating a community-based neighborhood garden, or creating a seed bank in your community. Direct action can also look like refusing the draft, withholding taxes because you do not want to support US imperialism, chaining yourself to a tree to prevent it from being cut down, or chaining yourself to a bulldozer that is being used for an oil pipeline construction. Direct action is when the disability justice movement blocked public transportation systems in order to make sure that those systems were accessible. Direct action looks like what the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense did when they patrolled their own neighborhoods to prevent cops from brutalizing members of their community. And direct action looks like what those who were enslaved did to escape from plantations. Direct action looks like communities offering sanctuary to undocumented immigrants, regardless of the fact that the US government considers it illegal. In addition to fighting systems of power and oppression, many social movements also create communities of care, and do not rely on existing systems to support and sustain their community. This element of movement strategy is called mutual aid or community care. Mutual aid has been a practice in many communities and cultures for a very long time. These projects are essentially a form of political participation in which people collectively take care of one another, and not just through symbolic acts or putting pressure on representatives, but by actually building social relationships that are more survivable. We recommend the book Mutual Aid, Building Solidarity During This Crisis and the Next by Dean Spade, a longtime activist and organizer. He proposes four key questions for evaluating the success of a mutual aid effort. First, does it provide material relief? Second, does it leave out an especially marginalized part of the affected group? Third, does it legitimize or expand a system we are trying to dismantle? And fourth, does it mobilize people, especially those most directly impacted, for ongoing struggle? There are several groups that have been involved in mutual aid work in Grand Rapids over the years. The Bloom Collective hosted several of the first Really Really Free Market events around 2007 into 2008. Really Really Free Markets are where people bring items they no longer need and then people take what they need, which means no one is buying or selling. In 2017, Grand Rapids Rapid Response to ICE started practicing mutual aid by providing material support to immigrants that are impacted by ICE violence. The Grand Rapids Area Mutual Aid Network, which was created at the beginning of COVID in March 2020, also does amazing work in this community and has provided lots of material aid, including raising hundreds of thousands of dollars of mutual aid for primarily BIPOC, queer, trans, disabled, and immigrant neighbors in the greater Grand Rapids area. There have also been amazing mutual aid projects that have been created to respond to particular crises over the last decade or so. Some inspiring examples are how quickly grassroots mutual aid groups responded to Hurricane Sandy and the fires in Los Angeles last year. There are also other groups like the West Michigan Care Collective and Grand Rapids Pullover Prevention. Throughout history, there have been fabulous examples of communities practicing mutual aid. One of the most overlooked is the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. The Black Panther Party is inaccurately represented by systems of power and oppression as simply being gun-wielding thugs, but nothing could be further from the truth. The Black Panther Party was part of the larger Black freedom struggle and began in 1966 with their 10-point program, which provided a framework for what they wanted. It is true that the Black Panther Party engaged in armed self-defense, but they saw that as only one of their survival programs. The Black Panther Party's survival programs were mutual aid projects, and they developed over 60 of them during their short history. People are somewhat familiar with the Children's Breakfast Program, but most people don't know that they had their own ambulance service, free commissary for prisoners program, free clinics, their own newspaper, and liberation schools. These kinds of autonomous mutual aid projects need to be explored and practiced if we want to develop real people power. The history of social service programs that make up the larger U.S. government safety net, particularly the programs that began after the Great Depression, did not come out of nowhere. In fact, there were two primary factors that determined much of what we often call the New Deal programs. First, the New Deal programs that provided material support to families deeply impacted by the Great Depression were modeled after the people-created projects that came directly out of those most impacted. See Dana Frank's book, What Can We Learn from the Great Depression, for more information. Second, the New Deal policies that the FDR administration put in place were a direct response to the massive public pressure from working-class people and organized labor. In the early 1930s, there were over 1,000 labor strikes happening on an annual basis. The U.S. government was forced to create the New Deal programs because of the massive resistance to capitalist economic conditions. If the FDR administration had not passed New Deal policies, the public would have been in open rebellion against the government. And just to be clear, the New Deal policies did not benefit everyone, especially groups that were hit the hardest from the Great Depression, like non-whites. The point is that if we just want to get rid of Trump and Musk, then we will continue to perpetuate systems of power and oppression. We have to come to terms with the fact that the current political systems, the neoliberal economic system, which is also driven by U.S. imperialism abroad, a system which is bipartisan, is the very system that produced the likes of Donald Trump. Over the past few months, especially at the larger rallies, those rallies that will not save us, we have seen signs that say things like defend our democracy or protect the Constitution. We in no way want to defend democracy or protect the Constitution, especially since the Constitution and the so-called democracy in the U.S. has been built on genocide, slavery, white supremacy, capitalism, patriarchy, and ecological devastation. We don't want to fight, to struggle, or to take risks, all for some sixth-grade notion of what democracy is. We don't want to pledge allegiance to some flag or give away our power to a government structure that was designed to benefit the wealthiest people. As John Jay, a founding father and former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, famously stated, quote, "Those who own the country ought to govern it," end quote. Our so-called democracy was designed the way that John Jay and the founders intended. While we are engaged in developing strategies to dismantle systems of power and use disruptive tactics and direct action, we need to simultaneously develop our own systems of governance. The immigrant-led group Movimiento Cosecha GR often says, quote, "What we need is already right here in our community," end quote. What Cosecha organizers mean by this statement is not just material needs, but ideas, vision, and radical imagination. Imagining that another world is possible, and we don't have to settle for what systems of power and oppression give us. As the great Puerto Rican poet Martin Espada once said, "No change for the good ever happens without it being imagined first, even if that change seems hopeless or impossible in the present." We don't want to go back to normal. normal in the US leaves us with mass incarceration, the climate crisis, a housing system that is rooted in profits, police brutality, and a political system that is antithetical to real democracy. The system isn't working for most of us. So instead of just hoping for mild reforms and lesser of evil politics, why don't we practice solidarity, mutual aid, and fight like hell for collective liberation? If you're looking for opportunities to get involved, Movimiento Cosecha GR is inviting people to participate in several upcoming actions to send a message about resisting mass deportation and to promote what the undocumented immigrant community is demanding. Cosecha GR is asking people over a four-day period from May 1st to 4th to join their actions and to not work, to not send your kids to school, and to not shop. On May 1st, we will be marching from Clemente Park starting at 4 p.m. On Friday, May 2nd, there will be a community solidarity gathering, a time to share food, hear music, and build community. The location for the March 2nd event is CECOM, located at 1545 Buchanan Avenue Southwest in Grand Rapids. On Saturday, May 3rd, Cosecha will be doing a salsa shutdown. May 4th does not have any events planned, but we ask that you continue the boycott. Additionally, on Monday, April 14th, there will be a crowd safety training from 6 to 8 p.m. at Oakdale Park Church, located at 961 Temple Street Southeast in Grand Rapids. We need people to attend this training for crowd safety in order to have lots of people keep immigrants safe for the May 1st through May 4th actions. Then, on Monday, April 21st, Grand Rapids Rapid Response to ICE will be hosting another training for those who want to be involved directly in the work they do, both to mobilize people to directly intervene to prevent ICE from apprehending people, and the mutual aid work, which provides a whole range of ways to practice solidarity with immigrants that have been impacted by ICE violence. The April 21st training will be held at CECOM at 1545 Buchanan Avenue Southwest in Grand Rapids. You must register for the April 21st training since there is only room for 50 people. Lastly, Movimiento Cosecha and GR Rapid Response is working with No Detention Centers Michigan for an action on Thursday, April 17th for Community Not Cages Action. The action will likely take place at one of the ICE offices in Grand Rapids to talk about the campaign of resistance against the newly acquired prison in Baldwin, Michigan, which was purchased by the GEO Group Corporation. Check out the GR Rapid Response to ICE Facebook page for upcoming details. This has been your GRID Weekly Digest. Come back next week to stay up to date on the local happenings, and remember, if you walk through life and don't help anybody, you haven't had much of a life.